It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. And right now, we've got Jim Lehrer on our minds. The longtime PBS News anchor died yesterday. He was 85. He was there for Watergate and for the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. He moderated more presidential debates than anyone in U.S. history. And as we look at the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump this morning, we carry his spirit with us. Now, it's the third presidential impeachment in American history. President Trump is on trial in the U.S. Senate, and you're part of this discussion. We want to know what stuck out to you about this impeachment trial so far. Share your take with us at 800-642-1234. We've got Alan Lichtman here. He's a distinguished professor of history at American University. He co-developed a prediction model that successfully called every presidential election since 1984, including Trump in 2016. Also the author of several books, including the 2017 one called The Case for Impeachment, which focused on President Donald Trump. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
You know, we are on the third day today of the impeachment trial where Democrats are continuing to lay out their case for convicting and removing President Trump from office. From what you've seen so far, what's still on your mind that you've so far seen on the Senate floor?
Well, we still haven't heard much about the obstruction of Congress case. That's what's going to happen today, the second article of impeachment. But I think some very significant things happened yesterday. First of all, Jerry Nadler, who had come in for a lot of criticism for kind of attacking senators for a cover-up, did a masterful job of exploding a fundamental argument of the Republicans that there had to be a statutory crime for there to be an impeachable offense. He effectively used Republicans' own allies, Lindsey Graham, perhaps Donald Trump's greatest defender in the Senate, the William Barr, the Attorney General, Alan Dershowitz, one of his lawyers, to show that, in fact, the consensus is impeachment focuses on abuse of power. And indeed, two of the three articles that were voted against Richard Nixon and caused the Republicans, his own party, to drive him out of office were for abuse of power and contempt of Congress. Second, they completely shredded the Republican argument that the real reason for the withheld aid and the withheld White House meeting was concern about corruption. They showed Trump had no concern about corruption under a previous corrupt administration, let the aid go through, and then suddenly, when an anti-corruption crusader was elected, withheld the aid and dangled a White House meeting. And Trump never mentioned corruption to President Zelensky, even though his national security staff had stressed that he must. And there was no review of corruption or anything else during the period of withheld aid. Third thing that struck me was that the managers shredded the argument of kind of no harm, no foul. Well, we released the aid, so nothing mattered. They released the aid so late and only after they were caught by the whistleblower and the announcement of a House investigation. So late that it all couldn't be spent by the end of the fiscal year without a special piece of legislation passed by Congress. And even today, not all of it had been dispersed to Ukraine, whereas the Department of Defense had certified that Ukraine had met its anti-corruption benchmarks and was ready to disperse the aid on June 18th.
Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University, and we're talking about the ongoing impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate of President Donald Trump. For those who've never seen an impeachment trial before, this is not like a typical, you know, as you mentioned, criminal trial. So how is this different by design?
Well, U.S. Senate under the Constitution has sole authority to try the president. So the Senate simply can set its own rules. And Mitch McConnell, who astoundingly has violated his oath to be an impartial juror, said, "I'm coordinating with the White House." Can you imagine the judge or the jury in a criminal case coordinating with the accused? It's unthinkable. But he has set up rules to make this not like a real trial. He has set time limits for the presentation by the managers and the defense, and he has blocked any witnesses or production of documents. In an ordinary trial, you call witnesses, you examine the witnesses, you cross-examine the witnesses, you present new evidence. Now we're just getting presentations by lawyers, and rather lengthy presentations by lawyers. And so far, there's no indication that late in the trial, when there's going to be votes on witnesses and documents, which the president has blocked, that enough Republicans will go along to get witnesses and documents. But that remains to be seen. There is still that opening, but it's coming quite late in the trial, after the opening statements, after 16 hours of senator questions.
And certainly, you think that you've said that you think that the managers have done a great job of destroying the arguments of the Republicans of the White House. Will we hear from that side in this impeachment trial so that we have this adversarial system, or will that not happen?
You will hear from the other side. You will hear from the other side starting tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They, too, have 24 hours to make their case, divided up into 3 8-hour blocks, but there is some indication that they will not take all of their time. Unlike also a normal trial, there is no time set aside for the prosecution to do a rebuttal because the prosecution has the burden of proof. In a normal trial, they have an opportunity to bring on rebuttal witnesses or rebut the case made by the defense. There's no provision for that here. So they'll have to rely on the question period to rebut the defense.
And Alan, I know this is a very big story and a very short amount of time to catch people up on it, but I do want to get your take in this last minute or so to help us understand your perspective. All of this is being, unless you can sit there and watch the whole thing, all of this is coming through news media, reporters and political pundits getting this information to the American people. So what are your thoughts on coverage of the trial?
I think the coverage, for the most part, has been pretty fair, except probably for Fox News, which is not given full coverage and has instead presented pro-Trump opinion. But otherwise, for most of the media, I think people are getting a pretty straight story. But I would recommend to all of your listeners that you tune in at least to the late period tonight, prime time tonight, because then you're going to get the sum up of what the House managers believe they have proven. And let's keep in mind, these are the grave, whether you believe the charges or not, they are the gravest charges ever leveled against an American president, that this president has undermined our democracy, sacrificed our national security to help him cheat in an election. Richard Nixon tried to cheat, but his was a domestic political operation. No president has compromised us by bringing in a foreign nation. And already, Russia has joined the fray by hacking into Burisma, the company on which Hunter Biden sat on the board.
Alan Lichtman, not mincing words here. Right. Alan, thank you so much for this quick catch-up. I'm sure we'll talk to you in the future. Thanks for your time.
Sounds good. Take care.
Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University. That Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes today at noon with the House impeachment managers concluding their opening arguments. Hear that live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Here on the Ideas Network, we're keeping you up to date on the latest and inviting you into the conversation. So if you want to tune into that live impeachment trial coverage, you can do that starting at noon on WPR's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. More of The Morning Show is up ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being here. I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, we're talking to a physician who says the state's pediatric intensive care units are full of babies who need oxygen. That's because of RSV. It's a virus that causes cold symptoms in most people, but is really serious for our most fragile. What do you want to know about RSV? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. That conversation is still ahead. First, new regulations on firefighting foam with PFAS chemicals are headed to Governor Evers' desk after the State Assembly approved them back on Tuesday. We're getting a better understanding of what PFAS are and their health risks. UW-Madison environmental engineering professor Christy Rumicall recently broke down the basics in a piece for wiscontext.org. She talked to the Ideas Network's Judith Sears-Poisson earlier this week.
Let's start with the basics. What are PFAS?
So PFAS is a term that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. It's a group of over 5,000 or so synthetic chemicals. These chemicals have a lot of valuable properties, and they're used in a lot of different applications. So they can make surfaces non-stick or waterproof. So they're used in things like furniture, carpets, paper products, things that we use every day. They're also used in firefighting foams and many industrial applications as well.
We often hear PFAS called forever chemicals. What does that mean exactly?
So they're called forever chemicals because some chemicals that fall within this class do not have any known natural degradation processes that happen in the environment. So chemicals like PFOS or PFOA, scientists don't know yet if they break down at all in the environment. We estimate that they last a really long time.
Whereas some other chemicals might be broken down by, say, sunlight or some other things that they come in contact with in the environment.
Exactly. My group works on other kinds of chemicals like pesticides, and they can be broken down by microbes or sunlight. As you said, there are other processes, and these chemicals don't really degrade by those kinds of mechanisms.
You mentioned some of the ways that we see PFAS being used, for instance, in Teflon coatings, nonstick waterproofing. There's also the big area of firefighting materials. Tell us a little more about that.
Right. So PFAS have been used in firefighting foams, mainly by the military and airports, but they're also used at sort of your regular fire station down the block. They help. They resist really high temperatures, and so they're really useful. They make firefighting foams more effective. And so we often find contamination of PFAS in sites, you know, near airports or military installations because of the use of these firefighting foams.
How long has this group of chemicals been used widely?
That's a really good question. PFAS have been in the news a lot lately, but they've actually been around a really long time. So some of them have been used since the 1940s and 50s.
And apparently for decades, they were used a lot. When did the risks first become known and points of concern?
Right. So they've been used a long time. I'd say scientists started measuring PFAS in the environment in the early 2000s. That's when people in the research community and other groups sort of started noticing that these chemicals were being found everywhere, and some of the concerns started coming out about them.
And what are some of those concerns? What are impacts? Let's start maybe with human health.
Right. So it's important to remember whenever we're talking about PFAS that we are talking about thousands of chemicals. Some of them have very well documented health effects, and some we really don't know very much about at all. So some that we know a lot about are things like PFOA and PFOS. These have been linked to a variety of health effects, including things like thyroid disease, decreased fertility, pregnancy issues, immune response issues, and increased cholesterol. There's also some evidence of certain types of cancers, primarily among people who, you had high exposure, so occupational settings.
I think I remember reading that virtually everyone in the United States has some PFAS in their bodies. Is that correct?
Yes, that is true. I mean, we use these chemicals in many different applications, and they also build up in your body with time. I guess once they're in your body, it can take years for them to leave again. And so, yeah, that's sort of one thing we're worried about is that the sort of constant exposure to them, they can build up with your body in time. And so, yep, pretty much everyone in the U.S. has some PFAS in them.
And how are we actually taking those chemicals into our bodies? I mean, I know that they're used in a variety of products, but what do we do that then makes them makes us susceptible to having them inside us?
Right. The main route of exposure to humans is ingestion. That could be, say, food contamination. So if you have like a microwavable popcorn bag that has PFAS in it, you could get it through your food. Drinking water that's contaminated with PFAS is a big concern. So if your water source has PFAS in it, that's a really important route of exposure. Or fish that live in contaminated environments can be another major route of exposure as well.
I certainly hear a lot with fish, especially, or seafood, about mercury and other contaminants, but PFAS is one of those that we should be aware of as well.
It is. The DNR came out with some fish advisories, or they're coming out with it, related to PFAS contaminations measured in fish in Starkweather Creek, which is located in Madison. And so that's something I think we'll be seeing more of in the future.
We're talking right now with UW-Madison Environmental Engineering Professor Christy Remickel. She recently broke down the basics of PFAS chemicals in a piece for wiscontext.org. So we talked a little bit about the impact on human health, and we talked about the fact that it can be found in animals like fish. What about other environmental impacts?
All right. So this is something that we work on, is studying the fate of these chemicals in the environment and where they move around and where we need to look for them. These chemicals, because they can dissolve really well in water, they move around in the environment. And so one thing we're looking at, our work is focused up in the Marinette area, looking where these chemicals end up in surface waters, so rivers, Green Bay, Lake Michigan, and also the concentrations in sediment. So, yeah, there are lots of ways they can move around in the environment.
So that area around Marinette was a big focus because of the Tyco factory, mm-hmm. I believe, and the firefighting foam that contaminated water locally. For people in other parts of the state, or even in other parts of the Midwest, how does that translate into a risk for their own water sources?
All right. So there's a lot we don't know. I mean, the DNR is doing a lot of testing and looking for contamination. I think we'll find more of these chemicals the more that we look for them. So I think it's just, people knowing that this could be a potential issue and sort of finding out what's in their own water as much as possible.
And water processing plants or filtration plants take care of a lot of things that can be harmful to human health, but this is not one of the things that gets screened out.
Exactly. So sort of traditional drinking water treatment processes are not designed to remove these chemicals. That being said, there are sort of commercial methods for removing PFAS from water. So things like activated carbon or reverse osmosis can remove PFAS from water. And these can be used either at the municipal scale or at the point of use, like at the home scale. So there are technologies available that do work for removing the chemicals.
Christy, in your research into PFAS, has there been anything that really surprised you that you found?
Our work is really just getting started. I'd say one of the biggest surprises in general in sort of my area of work is that the measurements that we make in the lab don't always match up with what's happening in the environment. And so to talk about PFAS specifically, and this is not my work, what others have seen is that if we look about how much these chemicals end up in the sediment, so the sort of sand and rocks at the bottom of a lake, we actually find a lot more there than you would predict based on laboratory measurements. And I've seen this with other chemicals as well. And I think this is really an important reason why we should get out of the lab and make measurements out in the field, because things happen in the environment that don't always match what happens in the lab.
And what are some of the challenges of studying these chemicals and then potential efforts to regulate them?
So one thing that's been really challenging and why this has sort of gotten a lot more attention recently is that these chemicals are hard to measure. We're talking about really low concentrations here. You have to use very precise methods. And these chemicals are so widely used that you have to be very careful with background contamination. So in the LCMS, the instrument that we use for measuring these chemicals, we had to switch out a bunch of parts that had PFAS in them in order to make our measurements. And so there's a lot that goes into doing the methods, and you have to be really careful with it. And that is, we kind of as scientists are just kind of able to do that really well in the past decade or so. So that's one thing that's a challenge, but also is why we're able to sort of make progress with it now.
And as we wrap up, are there places around Wisconsin that are trying to be more proactive in dealing with the potential health issues and environmental issues related to these chemicals?
Right. I mean, that's a really good question because, there are regulations that are being sort of going through the rulemaking process in Wisconsin, but we don't have regulations on the books for these chemicals yet. And so there are some utilities, like the Madison Water Utility is a good example. They've been making measurements in all of their groundwater wells and reporting that data. And I think they're being really proactive about making the measurements and telling people what's there and kind of dealing with with the results of that. But I think that's a really good thing. If you kind of have to find out if it's an issue, that's the first place to start.
Well, Christy, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Christy Remicall, an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UW-Madison. She talked with the Ideas Network's Judith Sears-Boisson about her PFAS explainer, which you can find at wiscontext.org. Up next is news. Then we're talking about a virus that makes it hard for babies to breathe, and sometimes it puts them in the hospital. So have you encountered RSV this season, or maybe sometime in the past? Perhaps you've had a child or know someone who's had influenza. What are the particular challenges that you've faced? Share your experience with us now at 800-642-1234. That conversation is just ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Influenza and cases of a respiratory virus called RSV are so bad right now that American Family Children's Hospital in Madison is restricting visitors to the hospital. It starts today, and kids under age 12 are not allowed to visit inpatient units at the Children's Hospital. A release says the last time visitors were limited like this was back in 2009, when H1N1 was the concern back then. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network, and I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about RSV and other illnesses that threaten babies this time of year. Join the conversation. What do you want to know about RSV? Has it ever hit anyone in your family? What do you want people to understand about the risks of illness this time of year? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at that number. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. John Taylor is a Prevea Health pediatric intensivist at HSHS St. Vincent Children's Hospital in Green Bay. He provides special care for critically ill patients. Dr. Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you.
Help people understand RSV a little bit better. How do you describe this virus?
RSV is a virus that causes a cold, sniffles, runny nose, cough, congestion. The population that is most affected by this virus is the young children, under a year of age, particularly under 6 months of age, and even more so if they've been born prematurely. It also affects the geriatric population, so older individuals as well. And it causes a significant amount of thick mucus that is very difficult to cough out. And the younger babies, because they're not as strong, have a lot of trouble getting this mucus out so they can breathe easily. That also interferes with feeding. And if they can't feed, then they become a little bit dehydrated, and that thickens the mucus and makes it all the more harder to cough and clear things out. But for most children, it's a bad cold. Fever, feel crummy, cough for a few days to a week or two.
That seems like one of the reasons it might be extra dangerous, right? That this respiratory disease just seems like a cold to everybody else, but it poses this unique risk to these different populations. Do we take it a little, like, not seriously enough?
Oh, no. I think it's actually been very well promoted. The lay literature, parents' magazines, I think, address it actually quite well. 30, 40 years ago, we used to say, well, it's just a virus. Now we're able to identify a large number of different viruses on some tests that we can get information back fairly rapidly in a matter of a couple of hours. And RSV in particular is one of those viruses that has been identified with rapid testing for quite a while. There are a number of other viruses that we also see that cause similar symptoms. Again, in the younger population, when it's most problematic is because of their size and their inability to cough and clear the secretions.
What are you seeing in Green Bay as far as RSV cases?
This year, it's an epidemic that occurs every year. We see it sometime late November through March. And sometimes it's a little earlier in the year, sometimes it's a little bit later. We're seeing about the average number of cases this time of year, both on an outpatient basis, and the patients that I see are sick enough that they need to be in the hospital. Our numbers from an inpatient standpoint are about the same as they were last year and the year before.
Something like 87 children treated for RSV and 30 hospitalized at St. Vincent and St. Mary's Hospital since October. I understand you're talking with other hospitals across Wisconsin, too. I mean, do we know what the broader picture looks like?
I'm part of a group that connects all five of the pediatric intensive care units in the state, and we've been inundated throughout the state. The hospitals are full. As you mentioned, limitations on visitation at American Family Children's Hospital, it's the same in Milwaukee, and we have the same limitations. Trying to control the spread, both by not having young children coming into the hospital where we have a concentration of illness, but also trying to avoid those kids bringing something else in as well.
Yeah, what is it about the winter season that makes this virus more rampant?
Mostly it's that we tend to gather together. We're inside. We aren't spread out as much as we are in the summertime. It's easily spread by droplets. If someone coughs or sneezes, rubs their nose, it's easily then passed from person to person. This particular virus can lay somewhat dormant on a countertop for several hours and still be infectious, meaning if the droplet is there and you touch it, you can rub your eye, rub your nose, and get yourself infected. It passes from person to person very easily. And as we gather together in the wintertime inside with school and with work, and we're not separated as much, it's more easily passed. In the tropics, the monsoon time, when people are gathered together trying to avoid the rain, is when they tend to see RSV and other respiratory illnesses more.
Dr. John Taylor specializes in pediatric critical care medicine and works in Green Bay. And we're wondering, if you work at a hospital in Wisconsin, how are you dealing with RSV or flu cases? Maybe you don't work in healthcare, but your child got sick when they were too little for a vaccine. You can share your story with us at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Taylor, with such a highly contagious disease and hospitals treating patients who have this, how are hospital staff keeping the disease from spreading to other patients and families?
We're very cautious about isolation practices, so we gown with paper gowns, we wear gloves, masks, partly so that we don't take the virus from patient to patient, and also to protect ourselves so that we aren't ill. The nursing staff, the healthcare staff here in the hospital and at all of the hospitals, all of the children's hospitals, are dedicated to taking care of kids. And every year they step up, work extra shifts, and really are the linchpin for us to be able to take care of these kids when it's sometimes overwhelming with the number of patients.
When children, especially babies, have RSV, what symptoms are they likely experiencing that should raise those red flags for us?
The primary findings that parents will see is a thick cough, very congested, working hard at breathing, head bobbing, sometimes seeing the ribs sticking out, pulling in at the top of the chest, the bottom of the neck, underneath the ribs where the stomach seems to be working hard at breathing. Their breathing rate is fast, and sometimes fast in the 50, 60, 70 times a minute basis, where it then becomes very difficult for them to be able to suck and swallow, either breastfeeding or taking a bottle easily. So their feedings become poor, and their urine output becomes less. They have less diapers in frequency, and the weight of the diaper is less.
Speaking from experience, that breathing that babies have when they have RSV is just terrifying. My daughter had RSV when she was 3 weeks old and spent a week in the hospital then. And I remember how, like, her whole body just sucked into her rib cage and she was struggling. And I remember doubting myself as a parent, thinking, okay, well, is this really what they're talking about? Or is it too much? Or should I take her in? Or shouldn't I take her in? I mean, how can we try to navigate that when there are so many little things that we run to the doctor for? Because you don't want to expose your kids at the clinic to more stuff. And at the same time, like, how do we know where to draw the line? What should we do as parents?
Most healthcare offices have a very good setup triage system, giving a call and saying, this is what's going on, I'm concerned. But generally, parents have a pretty good instinct, even first-time parents who may call a little bit more often with what seems to be trivial questions. But if their instincts are telling them this is not right, this is something wrong, then giving a call or setting up an appointment to come in. And if they are particularly scared, then coming into the emergency room. Although, as you mentioned, the emergency rooms, the physician's offices, often are rampant with having ill children, and trying to avoid the spread is not being an area where that illness is.
Not all babies wind up in the hospital for a week on oxygen like my daughter did. So what is kind of the range of treatment if a child is diagnosed with RSV?
There's no specific treatment. As with a bacterial illness, something like strep throat, we give penicillin, antibiotics to treat the infection. RSV, as with almost all viruses, there's no specific fix, no medicine to make it any better, any faster. The supportive care is the primary process. We've tried asthma-type medicines like albuterol. We've tried steroids. Nothing makes the illness any better, any faster. The reason that we would send somebody home from the hospital if they've needed to be home is that their oxygen numbers on our monitoring are satisfactory, which we think of as generally in the 90s, upper 80s to 90s, and that their ability to drink is enough. So if they are evaluated in the office or in the emergency room, if their oxygen levels are low and they need supplemental oxygen above what we are breathing in room air, and if their ability to drink is not satisfactory, then that would be the time in which we would have them be admitted.
Dr. John Taylor stays with us as we talk about winter viruses that threaten the health of our youngest Wisconsinites. What are you seeing firsthand in your area of healthcare? Do you work at a facility that's dealing with lots of RSV cases, or are you seeing more flu cases? What questions do you have about things like RSV, which causes bad cold symptoms and can threaten lives? 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and our conversation continues ahead on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we have some serious advice for you. Don't kiss the babies. Really, this time of year, all kinds of sicknesses spread from person to person. We're talking about RSV and influenza that are dangerous to our tiny humans. Our guest says cases are surging earlier this year than in typical Wisconsin winters. And we're taking your questions. What do you want to know about protecting babies from illness during the winter? Do you have any tricks, like wearing your baby at big gatherings so you avoid passing them around? Has someone in your family gotten influenza or RSV? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We're talking with Dr. John Taylor, who's a pediatric intensivist in Green Bay, works in intensive care there. And Christina from Glenwood is ready to join this conversation. Christina, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. I appreciate the call. My sister's two-year-old granddaughter is currently infected with RSV, and I'm wondering, what is the incubation? How long is she contagious? And did you say there was a vaccine for this?
Thanks so much, Christina. Let's go first to the vaccine. Dr. Taylor, there is no vaccine for RSV.
There's no specific vaccine. However, for extremely premature babies, a very select number of children, we do have a medicine that is given on a monthly basis for the first, potentially in the first year of life, but this is a very limited number of patients that would get it, not a regular baby, but babies who were born very, very early, who have lung disease, who have some serious congenital heart defects, so that they can avoid having the infection or to try and temporize, make the illness less sickening to the child during their first year of life after they've gone home from the neonatal intensive care unit. For a two-year-old, there's not a specific vaccine. There is constant work trying to develop something like that, but nothing available at this time.
What about that incubation period, the time it takes for the virus to ramp up in the system?
As with most viruses, the incubation period is generally a few days. 3 to 5, 6 days is the usual time frame. So trying to avoid them during that period. And the contagiousness, how long they are ill and able to pass the virus, is probably a week to a week and a half. So avoiding the patients during that time period, if you're a family member or trying to isolate yourself, will help reduce your getting the illness, because it's an illness that they can get 1 year and get the next year and the next year, and adults can get it and not realize it and just have a bad cold and not realize that they have the potential of spreading it to grandchildren or other people.
Yeah, Christina, hopefully that answers your questions. And what are you seeing in your sister's two-year-old? What has she experienced?
Well, just as you said, it began with a real fierce cough. And she wondered, should I call or shouldn't I? Is this something that's going to pass? And so she didn't call. And then she brought her back home to her mom. And then her mom took her in. And now she's not letting her see it. So her granddaughter. So we're wondering how long might she have this illness as well?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, Christina. We'll go with that. We really appreciate your call. How long do people battle RSV, especially our youngsters?
The younger they are, the longer it takes to cough and clear these secretions. Generally, in an older 2-year-old, I would expect if they were to avoid the child for a week or two, that would be a reasonable period of time so that they aren't becoming ill themselves. Certainly, if she has any health problems, particularly heart or lung illness, that's an underlying problem, going a little bit longer to avoid getting it would be a good idea.
Thank you so much for the answers to those questions. Dr. John Taylor works with pediatric patients in intensive care in Green Bay, and we're talking about RSV and other illnesses that affect children. There's still time for your question. If you're wondering something about the flu or RSV, or you want to share your story about how you've seen a child affected by one of these viruses, Dr. Taylor, we can talk about a few other ailments that affect kids. I mean, this month, Minnesota health officials announced an infant died because of whooping cough. That's the first PEDS death since 2013. Wisconsin saw a few cases of whooping cough last year. How does that compare to RSV? How is it different? We keep talking about this fierce cough.
Whooping cough is a illness that unfortunately is easily prevented by having a vaccine, and by increasing the frequency of getting those vaccines, it does reduce the number of cases that we see. Even more than RSV, the secretions are very, very thick, and the whooping cough name, which is a common name for pertussis, is because the patient will cough so much that they cough their breath all the way out, and then they have to whoop as they take they create a whoop sound as they take a big breath in. Babies, especially under the month or two of age, oftentimes don't have the whoop. They aren't strong enough to do that. And one of the things that we find from a symptom standpoint is that they will have periods of apnea or stopping breathing. This season so far, we hear it. St. Vincent Children's Hospital have had two kids that we've hospitalized for whooping cough. And as a grandfather, my one of my grandchildren this year at a month of age, was able to stay home, but in the Chicago area had whooping cough herself before she could be immunized. So it's something that's out there, it's in the community, and very, very important to increase the frequency of vaccines. They are safe, and they can be very preventative, avoiding some very significant illnesses like whooping cough.
And that's like the flu, right? In that adults can get the whooping cough vaccine to protect other people, to protect babies from some circumstances like that, from exposure.
Correct.
Okay.
And we find that the vaccine does have a lifetime. It's not a lifetime vaccine. You have to have it updated, and adults are the primary population that have this bacteria, that they maintain the bacteria in the human population. So having adults getting vaccinated is important.
Makes a big difference. What about the flu season in Wisconsin? We do know a child under 10 has died from the flu in Wisconsin. The CDC's numbers show more than 400 people have been hospitalized due to influenza. What are you seeing in pediatrics in Green Bay when it comes to flu cases?
It's hitting very hard right now, and with the RSV and influenza, we're being inundated this year on top of each other. And we've had cases of the two in combination or with several other viruses that we can test for. It also has the same symptoms, cough, congestion, fever. If you're older, you're going to feel very uncomfortable. Body aches, and we're seeing a little bit more of the influenza B than influenza A here, but I've had cases of both, and typically it's about 50-50.
Is one more severe than the other?
No. Okay. They both will cause significant respiratory illnesses either way.
So it's a little more of a technicality there. I have one quick question, another audience question from our audience. How much should someone be concerned with disinfecting the entire house until they're rid of a virus? I mean, really, how do you get rid of this stuff?
The primary way is to wash hands as far as avoiding contact with spreading the illness. Will parents go home and sanitize the house after they've been here at the hospital? Yes, I know they do. There are all sorts of products. One part bleach, 10 parts water is a viricide, meaning it will kill the virus. Do they need to sanitize and bleach their entire house? Not necessarily. It will live, the RSV will live for a few hours on a countertop, and just general normal cleaning is going to be enough, and avoiding contact with runny noses.
And so more of that continual upkeep on as far as the hygiene goes. Dr. Taylor, this has been really crucial information. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. John Taylor is a Prevea Health pediatric intensivist, works at HSHS St. Vincent Children's Hospital in Green Bay, provides primary care to young patients from newborns to teenagers. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.